This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will be back next week. Coming up, Benton Harbor, Michigan's most prominent activist is on lockdown in his own house. The United States finds another excuse to increase its military penetration of Africa. And Mumia Abu-Jamal speaks on the racist rich. But first, activists set up tents in front of the Federal Communications Commission's offices in Washington to demand the FCC cancel plans to create a two-tier internet, one for big corporations, the other one for the rest of us. Kevin Zeiss is an organizer of Occupy the FCC. He says the fate of internet neutrality remains unclear.
Well, we're still in limbo. What changed was a lot of pressure, not just from our Occupy outside their front door for a week, but also lots of emails and phone calls and contacts from people. And they moved to the point where they wanted to compare the right choice with the wrong choice. They, of course, support the wrong choice, but the right choice is also on the agenda. So the next 4 months, we're going to see public comment periods that will allow people to get their views out, and of course we'll use other tactics as well to get our views out. The two choices come down to this. The one that they're pursuing is to continue to treat the internet as an information source, and as a result it has less regulatory control over it, versus what they should be doing, which is treating it as a common carrier, a public utility, which would allow it greater regulatory power. They've tried twice now to regulate the internet as an information service, and twice the courts have said they can't do it, they don't have enough power. I don't know why they want to continue to pursue the same failed approach, but that's what they want to do. If instead they move it to a common carrier, and what a common carrier means is that it's like your telephone. You pick it up, you call, you go wherever you want. Or a cab, you have a license to be a cab, but you have to pick everybody up. A bus takes everybody to the same places. There's no discrimination, there's no bias, there's no unequal access. It's equal access for everybody. So a common carrier will allow that, and then you could put in place net neutrality rules that would require that the carriers of the internet be neutral, that Comcast can take you to the web and you go wherever you want to go on the web. But for some reason, they're taking the other approach. And so our job now, we've pushed real hard, a lot of people pushed real hard to open the door to allow our view in. And so the chairman of the commission, Tom Wheeler, they say he wants to hear views on why, which approach is better than the other. You know, why people support the common carrier approach. And so we have a job now. We got to mobilize people to save the internet. This really is a high-risk moment, and we got to put a lot of pressure on, enough pressure to overcome the millions of dollars that Comcast and other big telecoms will spend. So it's our responsibility. If we want the future to be what we want to be, we got to get up and get active.
FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler is, of course, a Democrat. The last time there was such a big fuss about what the FCC was doing was under George Bush in 2003.
Well, in fact, all five commissioners have been appointed by President Obama. He's required to appoint two from the other party. They all have five-year terms that break up at different times, but he had all five expired during his tenure. So not only is Wheeler appointed, but all five, and all five were confirmed by the Democrat-dominated Senate. So this is very much a Democrat's responsibility, FCC. So I would really recommend to President Obama and all the Democrats in the Senate, they better start to push this FCC in the right direction, because the people are very clear what they want. They don't want a class-based internet. They don't want a two-tiered internet based on fees. They want an open, equal internet with no discrimination. That's what the people want. It's no question about it. So this is one more reason why people are getting turned off to the Democratic Party. They put in place five commissioners, and what do we get? We get the same kind of proposals that we see from the Bush administration and Republicans, the proposals that create a tier system. You know, we had not only Tom Wheeler come visit us at the NCAM, we also had one of the Republican commissioners, Commissioner Pai, come down to us. And Commissioner Pai said to us, which do you prefer, the chairman's proposal of the tier system or our proposal of the market system? And our response was, we don't want either proposal. This is not a lesser of two evils choice for us. We want the right choice. The right choice is a common carrier with no prejudice. And I thought about their choices afterwards, and I realized both choices reached the same result. Under the Republican proposal of the market, Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon are the big corporations that dominate the market and will gobble up more and more control of the market. Under the Democrat proposal, the chairman's initial proposal, the rigged system, they can have multi-tiers and people can pay fees. Comcast, Verizon, AT&T will dominate more of the market. So both proposals come to the same conclusion, domination of the market by a handful of big corporations. And what we want to see is a very different thing. We want to see a public utility. The Internet is there for the public good, not for corporate profit. And so that's why we're out there. That's why three of us, myself, Margaret Flowers, and Ken Ash, stood up during the hearing today and were escorted out by the police. We stood up to say what we wanted, why this is off track, how this was really part of the illegitimacy of U.S. democracy, that corporations rule rather than people. And all three of us were escorted out, of course, by the police. Surprisingly, not arrested. We appreciate that, but we still got our point across, and a lot of people heard it. And so I think there's a real sign of anger we're seeing. There's been over 3 million emails and petitions sent to the FCC urging net neutrality. So the people are really getting active, and I think we can overwhelm them if we really get mobilized and really push people to take action. So the next 4 months are critical for the future Internet. Get ready to get going.
The FCC says that it's powerless to not move towards a kind of pay-for-play system because of what the courts have ruled, but it won't reach for the power that the courts have said it must grasp in order to protect Internet neutrality.
You got it exactly right. The court ruled that because this is not treated as a common carrier, because the Internet is not a common carrier, the FCC's power is limited. All they have to do is reclassify. It was in 2002 that it was changed from a common carrier to an information service. Now it's time to correct that mistake and reclassify it as a common carrier. Then the FCC will have the power to ensure net neutrality forever. And we can make that happen. The door was open today. Now we all have to push our way through it and get involved and get active to push the FCC to do what the people want and not what the corporations want.
So in a nutshell, a Democratic-appointed FCC is so far refusing to correct a Republican FCC action.
That's right. Both parties are heavily influenced by corporate power and corporate money. You know, we have two wings of the corporate parties. They both have a little bit different philosophy. One prefers a rigged market. One prefers what they call a free market. Of course, it's not really a free market since the people funded the creation of the Internet. The people funded the research and development of the Internet. You know, local governments have given rights away to Comcast to put up their utility lines. You know, they've avoided also giving them all sorts of tax breaks. So it's really a very much a rigged, they call it a free market, but both sides really have their own version of rigged markets that really help the big corporations undermine entrepreneurs, undermine small businesses, and result in the worst service for consumers. You know, the United States invented the Internet, and now we're 30th in quality of services, speed, and cost. So we're going downhill because letting the corporations dominate. The city with the fastest Internet is Nashville, Tennessee, and they have what's called a public utility, municipally owned Internet. That's the fastest in the country. I think there's a lesson there for us to learn. We should learn it by treating the Internet as a public utility, a public good, not as a profit center for investors.
That was Kevin Zeese of Occupy the FCC. Most people are aware that Detroit is under the dictatorship of a state-appointed emergency financial manager who forced the city into bankruptcy proceedings. However, it is less well known that all of Michigan's large black population centers are under outside management, including the town of Benton Harbor. The town's most prominent activist, Reverend Edward Pinckney, has been charged with elections infractions related to an effort to recall the city's mayor, who Reverend Pinckney says is a stooge of the Whirlpool Corporation, headquartered in Benton Harbor. Pinckney is under house arrest.
Right now I'm bound, and it got me bonded in. I can't use a computer. I'm under house arrest 24/7. They come over and check on me every day, make sure that I'm in the house, make sure I'm not doing anything, make sure I'm not on the computer. You name it, they're doing it.
And how long will this situation continue?
Well, I don't go to court until May 30th. I'm believing that it will end then.
And what kind of impact is this going to have for your plans for the PGA tournament that Whirlpool so dearly wants to hold?
Well, we definitely got it organized, and it will continue. We will have occupied the PGA May 24th They're going to still meet at 10:30. The press conference is at 11 o'clock, and we're going to march through the golf course. So we're prepared mentally to do what needs to be done. We still got folks coming from all over the country, and I'm excited about it because people have been calling more now than ever before. I don't know what kind of turnout that we have, but I'm hoping that a couple of thousand people come in and do what they need to do and just show support, because that was one of the main things that they wanted to stop. They wanted to stop the Occupy the PGA.
Could you explain why you've been placed under house arrest, at least what they allege?
They allege that we did a recall of the mayor here, James Hightower. He's a stoolie for the Whirlpool Corporation, and he was losing 5-1. For every one vote he had, his opponent has 5. And they was very concerned about him losing the election. And then they did not want this guy named Marcus Muhammad, who happened to be a Muslim and a follower of Minister Louis Farrakhan, to be walking around when they come here. That's the main issue.
And what kind of penalties do you potentially face?
They're saying 20 years, which probably is life to me since I'm 65. We most likely would have an all-white jury, and we're going to have to deal with that.
What do you want to happen at the PGA tournament?
I want people there to understand that we have a major problem, not just in Benton Harbor, but around the country. And our theme is death of democracy, and it's not one thing, it's everything. That's what we're fighting for.
Well, how has democracy died in Benton Harbor, and what's Whirlpool got to do with it?
Well, actually, Whirlpool is behind it. We have our very own, what they call the emergency manager here. The emergency manager himself don't work for the people. It works for the other side of government and the corporations. So that's been one of our main fights against Whirlpool, who actually controls the emergency manager. And it would be hard for one to believe that Whirlpool actually controls that, but they do. They control everything in the city, from the courthouse, the judges. Everything that goes in and out of this community is controlled by Whirlpool Corporation.
You sound like you're describing a situation in which Whirlpool is the big house and the mostly black town of Benton Harbor is the slave quarters.
As a matter of fact, you are right on point. It is. It appears that way. If you want to live, if you want to work, most likely you have to go through Whirlpool. You cannot be against Whirlpool in any fashion because that's what they do.
And, of course, I'm sure you suspect that Whirlpool is behind the charges that have put you under house arrest.
Absolutely. This way they killed two birds with one stone. They killed the Muslim guy who ran for mayor, and they also killed Reverend Pinckney, they're thinking. But we're going to fight back, and we're going to win both of them.
Reverend Edward Pinckney in Benton Harbor, Michigan. The kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls by Boko Haram militants in Nigeria has opened the door to even deeper U.S. military involvement in Africa. Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka says the increase in violence in the region is a direct result of the U.S. and European war against Muammar Gaddafi's government in Libya 3 years ago.
My central argument is that basically we cannot understand the rise and the strengthening of Boko Haram, and indeed most of the radical Islamic activity in Africa, in Northern Africa and into Western Africa, disconnected from the events in Libya. With the destruction of the Libyan state, that created both a political momentum for the rise and the emboldening of the Islamic movement in Northern Africa. But it provided also a material source for training and equipment and for money that strengthened these elements across the continent. So when we look at Nigeria today, there's a direct link between that situation and Libya. Now, suggesting that there aren't serious internal issues to help to explain the rise and the strengthening of that movement. But in geopolitical terms, you can't completely understand it without connecting it, contextualizing it to what occurred in Libya.
In short, the United States and Europe pumped tons and tons of weapons into Libya, and of course the fall of the Gaddafi regime freed up additional weaponry. Now that's spread all over North Africa and beyond.
Exactly. And the scandal of all of this is that U.S. policymakers understood what they were doing in Libya. They understood that there was significant popular support for their revolution. The only element that was in constant opposition was, in fact, Islamists. And that was the element that they used based in Benghazi, the Benghazi area being the area that fed the area of Libya in which most of the international jihadists emerged from for years. The U.S. policymakers understood the alliance that they were forming in order to undermine and get rid of the Gaddafi regime. So that's why this whole discussion around the upcoming hearings on Benghazi in the U.S. Congress is so phony in one way, because we know that they're not going to go into the issue in any great depth, because they don't want further exposing of the fact that they were in bed with jihadists in Libya, and that they continue to sleep with these forces went into Syria.
Yes, the Republicans keep on pressing for hearing after hearing on Benghazi, but in a large general sense, there is no difference between the Republican approach to the region and the Democrats.
No, and the hearing that they want to, they're going to keep the focus narrow, basically just so they can pin down the Obama administration and to undermine Hillary Clinton. They're going to just deal with the events around the security issue. They're not going to delve into what the CIA station was in fact involved in Benghazi. They're not going to talk about the kinds of political forces that were involved in the overthrow of Libya. They're not going to make the connection between that involvement and the strengthening of these radical movements across Africa. That job falls to us, and that's what we have to raise, because you're right, there's no difference between those two parties. This is a political circus with one objective, to undermine Hillary Clinton's candidacy, which I don't care about, but it provides us an opportunity to raise up these other serious questions, because U.S. policy in Libya, U.S. policies across Northern Africa are also being replicated in their support for right-wing regimes and right-wing movements across the planet.
In other words, if we do not intervene, the only thing that will be talked about will be the minutiae of the death of a U.S. ambassador and not how all of North Africa and beyond has been set ablaze.
Exactly. And it will continue to allow them to avoid those kinds of issues, the alliance that they have formed with right-wing forces across the globe. And it will allow them also to continue to manipulate public opinion, to find these highly emotional but real incidents like the kidnapping of these girls, to wrap themselves in this humanitarian cloak and further their countries in the world.
Yes, the Boko Haram kidnapping of the young women seems to be more useful to the United States even than the mere existence of Joseph Kony.
Exactly, because while Kony played a particular role in terms of helping to condition the American people to accepting more involvement in Africa, the stakes in Nigeria are much larger. U.S. policy for Nigeria is to keep the Nigerian government relatively isolated politically. They're concerned about the growing strength and influence of the Nigerian government. But in terms of security, they're not concerned about what's happening in northern Nigeria. They want an entry point into the southern part of the country where the vast majority of the oil exists, because they have a concern with securing those resources. They know that Mobil, Texaco, Chevron, and including Shell are upset that they are losing something like $6 billion a year from theft and sabotage. And so they want to secure those resources there, which means they have to put down the insurgency, the legitimate insurgency that's happening in southern Nigeria, the people I'm talking about.
You're talking about the people of the Niger River Delta, where the oil is.
Exactly.
Black Agenda Report editor and columnist Ajamu Baraka. On May 26th, activists will hold a No War rally in New York's Times Square to demand that the United States call off its offensive against Russia, what some people are calling a new Cold War. Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center was part of an anti-war teach-in at New York's Riverside Church.
The people of the U.S. can be a mighty force when aroused, mobilized, organized, And that's why we're here, because we need to begin to mobilize. This is dangerous, a dangerous world situation. But the times are also changing. The very policies the U.S. military imposes around the world are now coming home in massive austerity, cutbacks, low wages, and always combined with war, endless war. And that changes the material basis of every struggle. It's different conditions now. Now, people in the Ukraine at the grassroots gave a monumental surprise to the coup organizers in Kiev this past month. Washington's plan was to terrorize the population into silence. That's the role of fascist shock troops. Overturn the elected government. And the fascist forces thought they only needed the backing of the U.S., an invitation to the White House, a few billion in IMF loans. It was a done deal, facts on the ground. Or so it seemed. U.S. imperialism, in their arrogance, always, always underestimates the ability of people to resist. The workers in the Ukraine did something wholly surprising, unexpected. They rose up. They resisted. They're fighting back. That's important. They seized government and administrative buildings. They established their own military force. They set up roadblocks. They literally stopped the military and the tanks sent against them. The Ukrainian military disappeared. It melted away. They refused to fight their own sisters and brothers. And now U.S. imperialism has only the fascists to lean on. So what's happening in eastern Ukraine is really the first armed rebellion of this period against the banks, against the IMF, against the neoliberal program. This is the first armed resistance of a mass character. It's an armed, organized Occupy Wall Street, right? NATO's violent, high-risk seizure of Ukraine was part of a continuing plan for the dangerous expansion of NATO. And that's what this is about. Right now, as we meet, as we speak, the biggest war games and troop maneuvers in NATO's history are going on. And Russia today had their own nuclear war games, so it's getting pretty high stakes that we need to take very seriously. In the Ukraine, it was key to NATO's plans. They spent billions on it. They bragged about the billions they spent. The goal was ousting Russia from its military, its naval bases in Crimea, turning those into NATO bases facing Russia. That was the plan. Total conquest and recolonization of Russia. Wall Street is determined that there be no competing powers in Russia or China. It's encirclement. Those are their plans. Sanctions and threats. They wanted to seize the key industries of Ukraine, Ukrainian factories, by ending the export of critical engines and parts to Russia. 40% of Ukraine's exports to Russia are armaments and related heavy machinery, vital for the oil and gas industries. That's what they want to get a hold of. They wanted control of the oil and gas lines from Russia to Europe. They had lots of plans. They want it all. And they had plans for the people of Ukraine, too. What are their plans? Austerity. Everything to the banks. Loot the pensions, double the costs of fuel, cut the wages, make Ukraine safe for McDonald's. In Ukraine, the People's Republic of Donetsk raised surprising demands. Return the industries to nationalized ownership. Demand a say in economic decisions. Stop the sell-off of industries, reverse what's already been done, and have a referendum so that the people decide. And their fight is our fight. It's building solidarity with those fighting fascism in Ukraine that will raise the struggle here.
Sarah Flounders of the International Action Center. Greg Butterfield is a contributing editor of the Workers' World newspaper. He spoke to the teach-in about a massacre of at least 46 anti-fascists in Odessa, Ukraine, earlier this month.
I want you to imagine for a minute a meeting, a rally, a conference, not much different than this one, maybe a little bigger. Perhaps something that you've been to in the last couple of years, like an Occupy Wall Street encampment, or an anti-war conference, or a rally against police brutality. Imagine then that your event was attacked by 1,000 members of the Ku Klux Klan, armed, ready to kill, sent with the blessing of the government, with police ordered to pull back. Imagine then that these gathered activists were forced to take shelter in a union hall, and that the response of the Klan was to set fire to the union hall, killing dozens of people inside, both workers from the union and the activists who were sheltered by them. What would the response be of the movement here to something like this? I ask you to think about it because that's exactly the horrifying scenario that took place in Odessa just over a week ago, on May 2nd, where at least 46 people were killed on that day, most of them in or around the House of Trade Unions, where activists had taken shelter after their encampment, their protest encampment, had been burned with Molotov cocktails by the fascists sent by Kiev. Most of the people who died that day actually did not die of fire or even suffocation. Many of them were shot and killed through the windows of the building by the fascists before the fire reached them. Others tried to escape by jumping from high windows. Some of them died in the fall. Some of the survivors died after being beaten by the Nazis on the ground with bats and chains. And this is the reality of the situation that activists there are facing right now. And you can see why people in Donetsk and Lugansk and other areas have taken the initiative to protect themselves, have set up their own militias to protect themselves and keep the fascists out. There are those, even on the left in this country, who are trying to stay in the good graces, let's say, of U.S. imperialism, stay on the safe side of public opinion by drawing an equal sign between NATO and Russia over Ukraine, or even saying that, well, you know, Russia is so reactionary and these forces really just want to be part of Russia, the anti-fascist forces. So to hell with them, you know, if we're with anybody, we're with, you know, the Democrats in Kiev. And we say no to that. Look at the reality. Stop pretending with your insufferable Western racist imperialist arrogance that you know better than the fighters against racism and imperialism on the ground in Ukraine, the people who are fighting and dying, the people who, like us here in the U.S., are organizing against austerity and racism and repression.
Greg Butterfield of Workers' World newspaper at Riverside Church in New York. Jeff Mackler is a veteran political observer in Oakland, California, and a leader of Socialist Action. We asked Mackler if the Obama administration has crossed a line with its offensive against Russia.
I don't think it's crossed a line any more than it has by bombing the people of Libya to smithereens, murdering 1.5 million Iraqis, an ongoing war with death squad armies in Afghanistan. That's all part of the same war. The battle is for the imperial control of the Ukraine. Russia is a capitalist country, and the United States wants it to be subordinate to it so it can be ripped off and integrated into the world economy, and so its politicians can be subordinate to the world market controlled by the United States and the EU. I don't think it's going to come to a war, although the Cold War rhetoric is still there, but Russia is no longer a workers' state or a socialist state with a planned economy. So I think that the United States just has its eyes on Russian resources. It's the world's largest exporter of natural gas, oil, and fossil fuels. And it used to be a sixth of the land surface of the earth, and the world's imperial nations want to get their hands on its resources and on an educated working class. So I think that the rhetoric is going to be set aside for financial arrangements with the United States, hope to pressure the Putin government into making.
Many people speculate that this will push Russia and China even more closely together.
Well, I think that's been in the making for some time. The United States seeks to encircle Russia militarily, and of course that's not for their health. That's to limit their influence and their access to world markets. And China is heavily invested in the American economy to the tune of taking out American bonds to $1.3 trillion, and they know that the American dollar is increasingly becoming more and more worthless because it's simply a product of a printing press and the issuing of paper bonds rather than a reflection of real growth in the economy, industrial sector, and all other productive sectors of the economy. So the United States has a love-hate relationship. They don't mind dealing with China and using its labor force as the workshop of the world among the cheapest labor supplies, provided that American corporations like Apple Computer, for example, which has literally billions of dollars of profits that are in China that it hasn't repatriated yet in the United States until it can get the tax codes revised so it doesn't have to pay taxes. So the United States is interested in these being subordinate partners, and that is selling their workers their resources at the price of the highest capitalist exploiter in the West and in the United States. In retaliation, of course, the Russians and the Chinese, who are looking for a Eurasian economy, have much to gain by banding together, so to speak, to have a larger pool of capital to more effectively compete in a world marketplace that is increasingly globalized and constricted by U.S. imperialism.
The Russians are initiating a series of meetings to, as they put it, move towards de-dollarizing economic relations.
That's exactly right. The Chinese, they already have agreements with Japan, for example, to exchange oil in Chinese currency. And other nations are doing the same because they're fearful that the United States currency is so heavily inflated. I mean, it's off the gold standard since the end of World War II at Bretton Woods. But any nation on earth that tried to do what the United States does, and that is just print paper, and assume that it has a value on the world market, would soon go under. The fact that the United States has the most powerful economy, its promise to pay, even with printed dollars not reflecting real value, allows it, for the moment at least, to stay afloat. But I think that the chickens are going to come home to roost, as Malcolm said, and any nation that continues to inflate its currency with no corresponding production is going to face a world catastrophe. But the world knows that if the United States goes under, the world economy is going to take a major blow. So they keep on playing the game, but the Russians and the Chinese are hedging their bets, knowing that the United States is a casino or speculative economy, and they are shipping off the products of real labor and the resources that are material in the productive process in Russia.
The United States and its allies have used jihadists as their foot soldiers in Libya and in Syria, and in Ukraine, their point men are neo-Nazis. What does that say about the state of imperialism today?
Well, I think the Ukraine has demonstrated that the United States does not shrink from using any ally or force that can advance its cause. In the name of the war on terror, for example, that is the war on Muslims, it has no objection to using jihadists in Syria to overthrow or to establish regime change in that country. And in the same way, the United States claimed to be liberating Libya in a humanitarian war that slaughtered tens of thousands of people and wiped out the infrastructure of the country, only to have today the country in the hands of jihadist elements who preside over a state that essentially does what the United States wants. Any means are the rule today, including, for example, in Afghanistan, where literally half of the hundreds of thousands of soldiers were privatized death squad, Blackwater-type armies. They're at work in Africa. So when it comes to the Ukraine, the United States had no objection when it couldn't mobilize a mass force to challenge in the streets the Yanukovych government. It literally turned to the people who controlled the Maidan towards the end, that is the Independent Square, which were the right parties, neo-fascist parties. We can use the word neo simply because they're new, but they are old in the sense that they consider themselves armed and anti-Semitic, racist to the core, chauvinistic, super ultra-nationalist, and willing to use armed force. In fact, those arms don't come from nowhere. The United States was well aware of the fact that the right sector, which is a fascist party, to be impolite or to be accurate, and the Svoboda party, which has its roots in Hitler's party in the Ukraine, those parties were the ones that stormed the government, kicked out the oppositionists, violated the Constitution, and put five pro-fascist ministers in charge of national security in the country. The two heads of national security are none other than Svoboda and right party, right sector parties. Plus, they're in charge of agriculture and many other major ministries in the country. In fact, you might think that the United States would say, well, these are just temporary measures. We needed the Nazis to take power because there was no other force armed and willing to do so, but we'll move them aside. But the question today is, will the U.S. Democrats and the European Union move the Nazis aside, or will the neo-fascists who play leading roles and who are directing the army move the so-called democratic coup makers aside? Either way, the Ukraine in the West will operate at the instructions of the European Union, pay off the banks that loan the money. They're the first ones to get $5 billion of the $17 billion, and a right-wing government is there, ever threatening war. In the eastern part of the country, when people object, they are met with violence. Except initially, when the so-called Ukrainian government tried to send troops, they all deserted. Like in the Crimea, 90% of the soldiers in that country joined the Russian army. They were Ukrainian soldiers. They didn't like the Nazi propaganda or the austerity. And the same thing, in my opinion, is unfolding in the eastern Ukraine and the southern Ukraine. There are people who are well aware of the fact that they are facing a massive U.S.-imposed, European Union-imposed austerity program, not to mention massive firing of public employees, doubling the price of fuel, and increasing the burden of working people in every sector of the economy. So the United States has no objection to using jihadists in Syria, which it finances and organizes surreptitiously through Qatar and Saudi Arabia, or neo-Nazis in the Ukraine. And I should add that in Syria, for example, the United States formally says, well, we just backed the Free Syrian Army in trying to overthrow the government of that country. But in truth, the United States supplies the weapons to Qatar. Qatar has no army. It rents an army. It's called Blackwater. It rents a privatized army to protect the monarchy from the people in that country and serve as a foreign policy adjunct of the United States. So when Qatar arms the jihadists in Syria, what you're really saying is a U.S.-financed, funded, if not armed, private army is funding the jihadists. In other words, the money talks, and Qatar would have no army whatsoever were it not for the United States. And the same thing with the Saudis. Both of these instruments, whether they be religious-oriented fundamentalists, jihadists, or so-called democratic, as in the Free Syrian Army, meet in the same room and receive their instructions from Secretary of State John Kerry regarding what kind of government has to be established in Syria. The Syrian people, in my opinion, have long ago lost any influence in the decision-making. We see a proxy war being organized by the United States through murderous elements, and this will not advance the interests of the Syrian people, nor ever allow them to control their own country.
Back in 2011, the United States used the mere existence of Joseph Kony and his Lord's Resistance Army as an excuse to send special forces on permanent duty in Central Africa, in Rwanda and Uganda and the Central African Republic and South Sudan. Now we have the developments with Boko Haram in Nigeria. What kind of opening is that for an AFRICOM expansion?
Well, of course, if you read the newspapers, front page, the problem in the world is that Africa is riddled with jihadist terrorists who are indiscriminately murdering people and causing millions to be refugees. If you dig a bit deeper, you'll find that there is not a militarized force in anywhere in Africa that doesn't get its weapons from the United States or France or the former colonial nations that seek, if I may use the word, to recolonize that continent. It was really never decolonized. That is, the former imperial colonial overlords still maintain the economic power in the country, and today they're seeking to drive their military influence home. So when you have AFRICOM sending troops to some 30 countries or more, 5,000 American soldiers, these are death squad soldiers, these are professional killers, and they're setting up drone bases everywhere. Their modus vivendi is very simple. They go over to a government which has no weapons, and they say, you will do our bidding, and we will tell you who the president is, and we will take your oil. And if there's anyone who resists, they get shot. They're simply told that we will dial your number into our drone sector and wipe you out instantly. So what you have is a series of governments that are essentially controlled, financed, and organized, their military forces, by the United States government, and they exist in the name of fighting terrorism. Of course, the terrorists, in quotes, are the people who resist the total annihilation of the wealth of the country and its subordination to imperialism. Nigeria is a classic example. It's one of the most oil-rich nations. The Congo perhaps has the largest amount of natural resources in every conceivable metal, gold and silver and all kinds. And so it has become the subject of imperial interest. And the wars in that country are simply a reflection of the divisions between the rulers of the European countries and the United States as to who will grab the largest percentage of the wealth created by the people in that country and their resources. So I don't buy this war on terror. When the Soviet Union fell, it was a nation that occupied a sixth of the land surface in the world that had, the largest armies in the world, and it had deep influence everywhere. The so-called war on terror, where 1,000 American Muslims innocent, 100,000 have been interviewed by the FBI, is a fake war. It's a war against people in the name of capital. It is exactly like Remember the Maine or the Tonkin Bay incident, or even more recently, if you've read Seymour Hersh's magnificent articles, the sarin gas that was fired in Syria was organized by the jihadists with the help and knowledge of the United States government. And this was supposed to be a yet another pretext, the war on terror, for the United States to bomb to smithereens Syria. They never did that because the word was out that the jihadists were the ones whose rockets were shot on their own, literally on their own people. And why not? In the Ukraine, It is now clear from the evidence of the foreign minister of Latvia talking to a top American official that the people who fired on the Maidan Square protesters, which was the pretext used to remove the Yanukovych government, was not the Yanukovych military or police, but rather the fascists. They organized a pretext in order to raise the false flag and justify the illegal removal of an elected government in that country. In Africa, it's the same. Boko Haram is today's menace, but if you look into the history of that country, you will find that its tribal affiliates prior to the recent period were annihilated by U.S.-backed military forces in that country. That's the rule, not the exception. The rule that they would like us to know is that these African people just love to kill each other, that slaughter and genocide are the norm, and that we civilized people in the white nations of the world have to send our troops to protect the innocent, to provide food for them. The truth is elsewhere. The truth is that all of these wars are orchestrated, financed by the imperial nations in order to recolonize the country. The Belgian Congo was a classic example. King Leopold ran that country as his personal colony and killed more people, 12 million Congolese during the colonial era, a genocide that doubled the number of Jews murdered by Nazi Germany. You just don't hear about it because King Leopold and Belgium were civilized nations. They were carrying out the white man's burden and slaughtered. During the colonial era, the majorities of most of the colonial countries that became subject to the slave trade, tens of millions of Africans were slaughtered. That's also not part of our history. So when anyone tells me about genocide in that country and mass murder, the first person, group, party I look to it as the major imperial powers that have the weapons in the world and finance their own privatized armies, death squads, and so on to achieve their aims and use the victims to justify their dastardly deeds.
Jeff Mackler in Oakland, California. Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling is being punished by the NBA for his personal racist remarks. But Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, says systemic racism is the real problem, one that the corporate media doesn't want to discuss. Abu-Jamal has this commentary for Prison Radio.
When news broke of the comments of a wealthy NBA owner to his lover, it made me feel queasy. That's because some things should remain private, especially between lovers. It's not the business of the media, much less the government, nor us, for that matter. I feel this way even when the issue of racism is raised, for even racism shouldn't trump personal privacy. Nothing Donald Sterling has said has changed my view. Moreover, this event looks like episodic racism and reflects occasional eruptions, but also within the realm of the private. This ignores systematic racism, which, unlike episodic racism, which affects half a dozen people at best, has an impact on the lives and life hopes of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. An example. Many people will agree that mass incarceration has affected the lives of millions, disproportionately African Americans and Latinos. This was no accident. It didn't just happen. It was a specific policy of public officials like DAs, judges, and even the media. This was a racist policy made by politicians to play to the imagined fears of whites, of dark others. It was also a cynical political decision to exploit the sufferings of millions of people to enrich the prison industrial complex and boost employment in rural America, where most prisons are situated. It is this vast, impersonal, systemic racism that deserves our attention and our condemnation, not that of an old goat lusting after a 30-something and animated more by jealousy and envy than real hatred. But guess which one the media will exploit.
Political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, speaking from the state penitentiary in Frackville, Pennsylvania. In Philadelphia, public intellectual and activist Dr. Cornel West joined a rally for the reinstatement of Dr. Anthony Monteiro, whose contract was terminated by Temple University. Monteiro taught African American studies for 10 years at Temple. His former colleague, Professor Molefi Asante, has defended the firing by red-baiting Dr. Monteiro and his supporters. But Cornel West stands by Dr. Monteiro.
When you attack Tony Monteiro, you attacking a black man called Cornel West, too. Oh, yes. Ain't no doubt about that, brother. And I'm just by myself. You attacking Angela Davis. You attacking Du Bois. You attacking the memory of Paul Robeson. You attacking the memory of Sinclair Drake. I'm talking about a tradition. This is not just about individual.
Dr. Molefi Asante last year regained the chairmanship at Temple University's African American Studies Department on the strength of a campus community coalition organized largely by Dr. Anthony Monteiro, a veteran activist scholar. Monteiro and others linked the fate of African American studies at Temple with the struggle against gentrification of the surrounding North Philadelphia neighborhood and with larger issues of social justice. No sooner had the battle been won than Asante conspired with white university officials to terminate Dr. Monteiro's contract. Asante's behavior was typical of narrow cultural nationalists who wear Africanesque wardrobes and pose as the ultimate race men, but ultimately wind up as chief bootlickers, servants, and agents of white corporate power. When Temple University informed Dr. Monteiro that his contract would not be renewed, Asante pretended that he had had nothing to do with it. However, as the Campus Community Coalition intensified its demands for Monteiro's reinstatement with tenure, the administration outed Asante as the instigator of his colleague's termination. Exposed as a backstabber, Molefi Asante appears to have lost what's left of his mind. In a statement on his Facebook page, Asante lashes out at Dr. Cornel West, probably Black America's best-known public intellectual, and at Dr. Mark Lamont Hill, the Philadelphia native, Columbia University professor, and TV personality, both of whom spoke at a recent rally for Dr. Monteiro. Doctors West and Hill are dupes, according to Asante. So is Pam Africa, the sister at the center of so many actions in support of Mumia Abu-Jamal. The local community has been misguided by Monteiro, the Marxist, and his white communist allies, who, the red-baiter Asante says, are promoting an anti-African ideological view. Molefi Asante's McCarthyism sounds like a relic from another age. His incredibly poorly written letter reads like a script from a 1950s Red Scare TV show. Dr. Monteiro is described as skilled at propaganda in the vein of a leftist apparatchik. Asante attempts to expel black Marxists, or anybody black that he suspects of being Marxist, or dupes of Marxists, or people like Drs. West and Hill, who are doing their leftist duties, in Asante's words, to expel them from the black radical tradition, which Asante claims, quote, has always been black nationalist, unquote. This is some shrill and crazy stuff, spoken like a dashiki-wearing J. Edgar Hoover. When Asante says that Tony Monteiro is a low-level purveyor of Marxism and anti-African ideas, all you have to do is substitute African with the word American, and he sounds just like Ronald Reagan. Asante even attempts to take a swipe at Black Agenda Report, but says he's waiting for the ancestors to give him wisdom. That will be a long wait. In reality, Asante is just a rat who, as soon as a campus community coalition got him his job back, ran straight to the man, promising to get rid of these same radicals and activists who've been giving the university so much trouble about racism and gentrification. He is beneath contempt and neither a scholar nor a brother. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.